behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I'm Ben Bullen.
Ben, we've got another distant part two, if you want to call it that. Mm-hmm. This one goes back, what, 4 years now or something like that.
Ooh, right? Yeah.
I mean, we did Urban Legends, mm-hmm. I believe, and that was way back in 2010, I think, right?
Yes, sir, 2010.
And August of 2010.
Back when we were high speed stuff.
Yeah, I think, we were just car stuff, I think, at that point. Maybe. It was right around the turn, right when we switched over from high speed stuff.
Oh, okay.
So I think you may be right, Ben. We'll have to look into it. But we did do an Auto Urban Legends show, mm-hmm. and we've done a bunch of other stuff about urban legends kind of along the way. And I've got a few things listed here if you want to talk about it.
Sure.
I mean, which do you want to talk about first? Maybe the ones that we talked about initially in Urban Legends, or
Okay. Let's do the ones that we did in our original Urban Legends episode. I've got a list of them here too.
Okay, good.
And
just to be clear,
yeah,
we're not going to talk in depth about these. We just want to tell you the ones that we've already covered,
mm-hmm.
and then we're going to have a whole new crop of these things for today.
Yeah. So here are a few that we looked at last time, in 2010. We had the urban legend about the interstate highway system being designed for emergency planes. That's false.
Mm-hmm.
Or cell phones causing fires at gas pumps. Also false.
Mm-hmm.
Wife of James Brown trying to plead diplomatic immunity in traffic court is true.
Because he was, the ambassador of Seoul or something, right?
Yeah, he's ambassador of Seoul.
So that's true. That's crazy.
Yeah.
All right. And then we also had the Portuguese barn find cars, which were worth something like $17 million. Remember that 200 cars found in the barn? That was false.
Mm-hmm.
The red cars get more speeding tickets?
False.
Also false, yeah.
Which I thought would be true.
Yep. We had one called The Boyfriend. I don't know what that was.
Oh, that's the, is that the one with the hook? The crazed mental patient?
That could be. I think maybe that was a separate one, but we did have the hook with the crazed mental patient and the Lover's Lane tale, right?
Right, which is more of a moral cautionary tale.
Yeah, so that was false as well. We had the dead car smell thing.
Mm-hmm.
Can't get the smell of the dead previous owner out of the car. That was actually kind of unknown, but likely false because we determined that
you can get the smell out of anything.
Yeah, that's possible.
Any car smell.
The rattle trap, which dealt with the Queen of England and some stuff that she found in her, her Jaguar, right? And, that was true.
Yeah, that is, something that really surprised us.
Yeah. The Queen of England found some unusual items in her Jaguar's doors. So, you might want to take a listen to the episode and find out what that was.
Mm-hmm. And then we talked about, one of our favorite superstitions from, racing,
mm-hmm.
which was peanuts.
Yeah, the peanut shell curse, mm-hmm. From about 1937. And that is true.
Mm-hmm.
Which is another strange one.
Yeah.
Also, we talked about wearing seatbelts. Is that more dangerous, versus not wearing seatbelts? Definitely false. You should wear your seatbelt at all times. So definitely do that. The JATO rocket on the car, of course, we talked about that when we had to.
Yeah.
That was false.
Yep.
Obviously. Now people have mimicked that. Man, we talked about a lot of things
one.
We talked about vanity plates, a vanity plate that read, no plate.
Yeah.
And, supposedly the guy got just untold amount of tickets for that, right?
Yeah. It's false that it worked, but it's true that he tried.
Yeah. Yeah. True. Well, I guess true and false. Motorists, paying red light tickets with, one motorist in particular, paying a red light ticket with a photo of money. that is true, but there's a twist to that one as well. And I thought there was a clever twist. So, we'll leave that one up to people to listen to. The cruise control in the RV, the guy walks back, says, I've got it on cruise control. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
That's false, but, funny nonetheless. Yeah. The $50 Porsche.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about that one probably over and over many times.
We've said multiple
episodes. I think so.
I think because we both want it to be true so bad.
Yeah. With a variety of cars, like the old Corvette Stingray or something like that. It's always false. The bullet fuse, which is a funny one, a funny tale.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of hillbillies with a .22 caliber bullet for a fuse. That one was false.
Right.
And then the last one I think we talked about were kind of like these dead hitchhiker stories where, someone returns on the anniversary of their death to
a
certain road and
La Llorona and stuff,
Exactly, yeah. And you hear about it later. It's kind of the Pee Wee Herman thing, with Large Marge.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Oh, yeah. Tell them Large Marge sent you.
Unfortunately, that one's false. I kind of wish that was true.
Good, because Large Marge scared the crap out of me the first time I saw that movie as a kid.
Yeah. That was terrifying when it first happened. And then later, that's the part you fast forward to.
Look at the claymation.
Yeah. And we had some other stuff, Ben. Now,
mm-hmm.
these are, we won't, these are ones that we covered kind of individually, I guess, along the way.
Right. Yeah. We talked about, the Ferrari coffin. Remember that one?
Sandra West, the, the socialite who was wanted to be buried in her Ferrari 330 America. Mm-hmm. And, that one is true.
That is true.
Yeah. There was also shaken, stirred, and dumped in the ocean, which was, Aston Martin, the DB5, which was used in a 007 movie.
Yep.
And supposedly dumped somewhere off the coast of Florida for a, for insurance
fraud
scheme.
Or was it?
Yeah.
Right.
That one is unknown. So we don't know if that one's true or not.
It was really stolen though in a, in an amazing airport heist. You just have to listen to that episode.
That one is likely true.
Yeah. I'm really into that one.
It's a great story.
That's not the only legendary sunken car though, Scott.
No. We also talked about the Chrysler Norseman. And the Chrysler Norseman, both you and I think, love the Chrysler Norseman story.
Oh, yeah.
And the car itself. It's a beautiful car. If you've never seen the Chrysler Norseman, that legend, unfortunately, in this case, is true because that's one that is still underwater off the coast of New York, I believe, right?
Yeah. And in addition to having an amazing name for a vehicle, it's probably not going to be retrieved.
No, probably not. We talked about a monkey that has won some NASCAR races.
Oh, yeah. Jocko Flacco.
Jocko Flacco, a rhesus monkey who won a NASCAR race, I should say.
And let's put some finger quotes around one.
Yeah.
But he was in the car.
He was in the car. A rhesus monkey was in the car. And this is, you know, when they go back in the 1950s when it was a very different time in NASCAR, Ben, when something like that's going on. But that was a true legend as well.
Yeah.
And then the last one I think that really kind of qualifies as an urban legend type thing that we talked about was the whole thing with Henry Ford and the bank robbers writing him notes thanking him for the good fast getaway cars.
Oh, that Dillinger wrote to him. Yeah,
Dillinger and Bonnie and Clyde. Well, Clyde, I guess.
Right, yeah.
Wrote to him and said, "What a great car. Thanks for making him so fast and reliable. We're able to speed away from the banks and get away from the coppers every time."
And that is probably false.
No.
Well, wait. That's right. Oh, I forgot.
It was twisted to be false, but it's honestly, this is a true story. And you'll have to listen to the episode to find out what that means. Because
that's right. Yeah.
There's a secret letter, and then there's the letter that was released to everybody.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Okay.
And I know it's a little mischievous in the way that I'm saying secret letter and all this stuff, but if you listen to the story, you'll understand what it
means. And you'll enjoy it. Now, I would say there's one other one that we covered, which was the cursed Porsche of James Dean.
Oh, that's a good one. That's a very good one. Yeah, so cursed cars.
Yeah, we did cover cursed cars.
And we even talked about them in hearses. When we talked about hearses, there were cursed vehicles there as well.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Okay, so just all of this to say that if there's something we don't mention today, it's likely because we've already talked about it. Now, I got to tell you, I just listened to our first Urban Legends podcast again earlier this week, in fact, and I really liked it. We talked about some cool stuff.
We did, yeah. It was a fun one to listen to, and I've listened to a couple other ones. Like, I listened to the Norseman episode again this week just because – as soon as I heard the word, I thought, you know what? I got to listen to that again. I got to read up on it again. And I actually read the story that was in the book that I received where that whole thing came from. Fascinating story. So there's some really good urban legends out there. A lot of them have to do with cars. Not all of them, of course. You'll hear urban legends of all different types. And, you know, I guess we don't really need to go into what urban legends are all about or anything, but I think it's helpful to know that it's always kind of the secondhand story. It's always a friend of a friend. Yeah. And there's always alleged to be true. You know, it's like somebody tells you with the utmost sincerity that this is a true story. You got to listen to me. You got to pay attention to this. And you'll find that a lot of times the reason that happens is because there's a moral to be told there. There's a moral story, something that, you know, a lesson to be learned in some way. Right. And not just that, it's that, you know, there's a lot of different variations of the same story that we'll hear. You'll see that the topic generally falls under one of these type of categories. Okay, so there's things that people gossip about. So you'll find that, you know, death and sex and crime and contamination and technology, ethnic stereotypes, celebrities, topics of like that are just horrific, or somehow beating the system. Those are kind of giveaways that you're listening to someone who's telling you an urban legend. You know, you have to pass this on. Otherwise, you know, somebody's not going to be informed and something terrible is going
to
happen.
Right. Forward this email to 10 of your friends.
Yeah. And it's usually just really, really a strange story, almost too strange to be true in a lot of cases. And you'll find out that that's truly the case and that most cases it's not. So these things kind of pop up now and then. Online, of course, that's one place where these things have really, really.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, just, I don't know how to, they're very prolific, I guess, in that, you know, these stories that had once been passed on, you know, like maybe over a campfire somewhere or, you know, via handwritten notes that people had sent to other people.
Sure.
Now with online access and email access, everybody kind of feels free to spread these stories anywhere, and they don't really have to give it a source of any kind. They can just say, oh, a friend of mine said that this happened to them, so watch out for it in this area. And, oh, the chief of police in this town that's the next town over said this. And it becomes this this thing where people say, well, I better heed this advice. And you know what? I think I better tell my mom this because she would really need to know this because she's out late at night often, and she needs to know this as well. So I'm going to send it to her.
She's always picking up hitchhikers.
Yeah, and we should and we should send, you know, that she should send that to her friends as well. So
let them know.
That's how this whole thing goes. And these online stories, it just seems like with the internet, it's really just exploded.
Yeah, they thrive in the presence of the internet. Now, one other thing that we should also mention is that often these stories are kind of like what you would hear on, you know, Lifetime movies. They're inspired by true events. So there might be a grain of truth that has just sort of found like a grain of sand. It's found its way into the oyster of public consciousness, and it just keeps growing and accreting more layers.
Become a beautiful pearl
of absolute BS,
of lies,
of lies.
A pearl of lies. Yeah, that's right. So,
yeah,
you're going to see that you know a lot of these are going to be familiar when we talk about them. And you know, I just want to say that we went to Snopes for our list here.
Yeah, for
and
a lot of them.
Of course, we went there because that's one kind of the one place where you can go that kind of dispels what's true, what's not true, and they do a lot of really great research there.
Right.
And they find out, you know, where these things originate, where all of this comes from, and there's no way the list that I've got maybe a good 10 or 11 here.
Oh, cool.
That we can start with, and I don't want to go too deep into them, because if we just read every one of them, it would be very boring.
Right.
So we're going to kind of summarize them, and you can go online to Snopes.com and look up the exact same things, and they have a fantastic section that is just simply catering to automobile urban legends. And there's a lot of different categories. And I mean, just some of the there's like maybe 14 categories.
Yeah. And it's stuff like insurance, mechanical stuff.
Yeah. Cursed cars.
Cursed cars. Yep. Yeah.
Dream machines. Grand Theft Auto, auto erotica, which is cars and love affairs. Don't get any wrong idea. motoring mishaps and traffic accidents, things like that. So there's this huge, big group of automobile stories out there that you can just kind of delve into, and you could easily spend a day looking through this or a week looking through this, really.
Yeah.
And if you followed every link and tried to follow up on every story, it would take you forever, but they've done all that work for you. And one thing that they pointed out here, and I want to do this before we get into this whole thing of, you know, starting with our first urban legend. I was kind of wondering why people gravitate towards urban legend stories that have to do with cars a lot, because I've heard a lot of these through my life, and I don't know if it's just because, you know, my dad was into cars, myself, my brothers are into cars. I wonder if we just kind of heard these stories because that's what we're into. And I heard plenty of other urban legends as well, but that seemed to be the main focus. And then I realized that it's kind of like, this is something that almost everybody can relate to. Almost everybody has a car. Almost everybody's on the highways at some point in their life. You know, and there, a lot of these have to do with being just in the car driving.
Right.
You'll find that, you know, like the light flashing type thing or whatever. But a lot of people can relate to these stories. And they say that, you know, cars hold an important place in our hearts. This is from Snopes. They're all at one time. They're practical and whimsical. They're reliable and yet still frightening. They're mundane yet still exciting. They're necessary and exotic at the same time, and they're also commonplace and also very mysterious at the same time. So they've got this whole yin and yang type thing going on, right? And in other words, they're kind of like a mechanical expression of everyday life, if you want to think of it that way.
That's a really smart way to put
it. Yeah, I think it is. And it really kind of summarizes why these auto urban legends are so, I don't know, so prevalent in our culture. And so, you know, so often we hear about these things. And, you know, I just mentioned the light flashing type thing. I think a lot of people have heard that, the gang initiation thing. You know, we'll get to that later in this. But a lot of these begin with kind of the have you heard line.
Yeah. I've got, if you don't mind, I'll start with one.
Oh, please do.
Just that. Also, we should say, Scott, a lot of the stuff that you're going to hear me talking about in this podcast is going to be related to various conspiracy theories surrounding the automotive world.
Oh, perfect.
And yeah. I think they dovetail together nicely. So here we go, my friend. Have you heard about that miraculous car that got 200 miles to the gallon?
Oh, this is a good one.
You remember this one?
I do remember this one.
So here's the story. There's a guy who's worked for General Motors for years and years and years and years. And after he's finally going to leave and he's retiring from it, the company gives him a car as a retirement gift, you know, just an experimental mm-hmm. car that wasn't going to go anywhere. And, of course, this being in the heyday of GM union employees and stuff, he's got a nice pension, too. So his ticket is written. He can pick a car that he wants. So he picks a Chevy Caprice. Nice car, right?
Interesting choice.
Interesting choice. And he likes it. He, you know, it's roomy. It's comfortable. He's driving it for a while. And he thought, you know, I'm a good employee. I'm not going to get anything too showy or expensive, right? He notices that no matter how much he drives, the gas gauge is barely moving, right?
It must be broken.
Right. So at first he thinks, okay, well, the fuel sensor's messed up, right? So, he goes to the factory. They look at it. He gets his car back after, the mechanics act a little bit shady. And then he notices that its gas mileage is working, right?
Hmm.
But the thing is, he knew that there was still gas in the tank and everything. And, he learns that what GM did was replace his Chevy Caprice because the model that they had given him was a secret developmental model that had amazing gas mileage that big auto conspired to keep from the public. Mm-hmm. And that this is just the tip of the iceberg, as far as that goes.
So a super secret car.
Right. We've heard that, we've heard that thing. And, you know, like we said with other urban legends as, you know, like series of different endings or variations on a theme, right? Like maybe mysterious men from GM show up at the guy's house at one day, or maybe they're not GM, you know, maybe they're Ford. Mm-hmm. And, then they have other things that happen, but they all have the same result. The car is taken away and you and I, along with John and Jane Q Public, are stuck getting gouged by inferior technology.
Sure. They replace it with a regular car. He gets regular gas mileage then, and that car is shuttled away to some warehouse somewhere, right?
And if you don't forward this email, no one will ever know the real story.
Yeah, they'll know that GM is holding back on their 200-mile-per-gallon car, right?
Right. And as we know, that story is unfortunately false.
Yeah. And you know what? Right away when you said he could choose any experimental vehicle or whatever that
right.
he wanted to, you know, that right away tells me. But also the fact that, well, he took kind of a mid-range type car. That's another kind of giveaway, I guess. You think that somebody
right.
like that would choose something, I don't know, maybe a little flashier. I don't know. Maybe that's just me.
Mm-hmm.
And, let's see, what would the last one be? I guess maybe that, you know, if GM, I guess this is the biggest one, really. If GM was holding on to a car that actually got 200 miles to the gallon, I think they would release that immediately because they would sell a billion of these things instantly. I mean,
right.
it would, before it was copied by everybody else, of course.
Yeah.
They would sell out and it would be a huge, huge success.
It's not that, although it's easy, I think, if you're just in the public, I think it's easy to conflate the mission of an oil company, which maybe will be, of course, to find the most sustainable and profitable way to sell petroleum products. It's not the same mission as a car company, which is to find the most sustainable and profitable way of selling their products, which are cars.
Yeah, exactly.
This goes back. It's interesting because this kind of thing goes back to the 1930s. That's one of the earlier stories of, you know, the miraculous invention theme. Charles Nelson Pogue, patented a carburetor that was supposed to get 200 plus miles to the gallon.
I've heard that one.
Yeah, huge to do about it. I think this is one of the earliest origins of that kind of evil big auto thing.
Sure. Yeah, and we still hear about these today. I mean, even up until present day.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this is something that goes back 85 years. I mean, the car has been around for what, 120 years, something like that. This is, this goes back 85 of those years, maybe even longer than that. Who knows, really? I mean, probably word of mouth that went back farther than that.
Yeah.
Although mileage wasn't a huge concern back then.
Well, I will bring up another case later in the show. Just want to plant that seed.
All right. I'm going to have one that's just a little bit more whimsical, I guess.
Okay.
All right. And, this one is a legend. I'll just tell you right up front. It's a legend. It's one that's definitely not true. There's no truth to this one. But what it has is, and this has a, well, you tell you what, I'll tell you a little, the little synopsis of the story and then, and I'll tell you what it really comes down to. This one is about a motorist who mistakes a dustbuster, you know, like a vacuum cleaner, a small handheld vacuum cleaner for a fuzzbuster radar detection device. So the story is that there's a guy named Sergeant Larry and he, you know, this is just a general story from about like this comes from about, you know, 2000. So, you know, online, I think it was somewhere online. Sergeant Larry comes up to the car and he hears this humming sound as he approaches the car. They just pulled over for speeding and it's an old lady driving this elderly woman. And she's cursing these grandchildren who weren't even in the car. She's like, you know, damn kids, you know, grandkids, whatever. And he's wondering, like, okay, there's no one in the car. What's going on? He says, ma'am, what about the grandkids? And she says, well, they told me to put a dustbuster in my car and I wouldn't get a speeding ticket. And so he looks on the dash and there taped to the dashboard is a dustbuster that's whirring away. Oh. You know, it's on. And Sergeant Larry says, I think you've mistaken a dustbuster for a fuzzbuster. And he gives her just kind of a warning and sends her on her way, right? And that's really funny. And everybody, you know, it depends on the way you tell it. I'm not a very good joke teller, but you know, along the way, you know, you get the idea that, you know, this lady is making a critical mistake here.
Sure.
You know, mistaken the dustbuster for the fuzzbuster or whatever that her kids or grandkids said. What this comes down to is an urban legend, kind of a common theme, I guess. And that is a clueless female driver or a clueless elderly driver. In this case, it's both. And sometimes this is going to come down to clueless foreign driver.
Mm.
And this is a theme that you'll see throughout this whole thing. I mean, throughout any automotive urban legend, you're going to find these main themes that come up. And, it's just one of these things that like will pop up in different ways. And here's another version of that is that there's, of course, another clueless female driver who is driving down the road and she passes what she thinks is a microwave on the side of the road. A microwave oven. It's just sitting there on the side of the road.
Mm-hmm.
And she thinks, oh man, this is extremely lucky. There's no one around. It must have fallen off of a truck. I'm going to pull over and see what this is. So she runs back and gets it and she's thinking, you know, puts it in her car in a trunk and heads off down the road. And she's thinking, this is so lucky because my conventional oven has been, you know, on the fritz and, you know, I've been having a hard time cooking dinner for my family and, my neighbors are always bragging about their fancy new microwave ovens that they've got. And, you know, that's the way to cook, right?
Right.
So she gets a little ways down the road and the police pull her over and she's very nervous about this. Like, why would they pull me over?
Right.
So she pulls over. They ask her kind of what she's doing, what's been, you know, what's up. And she says, oh, nothing, just taking a drive, you know, down the road. And she's really clearly nervous, agitated, right?
Yeah,
and they say, well, do you have anything to say about this? And they point into the hatch of the car and they point to the box that's back there. Mm. And she's real sheepish about it and says, well, I thought it fell off the truck. You know, I just wanted the microwave oven. They say, well, that is a radar speed trap box. And we've been watching you ever since you picked it up off the side of the road. So she picks up this police device that's meant for speeders and throws it at the back thinking it's a microwave. And it's just one of these things where like, this is this depiction of a clueless female driver mistaking something that is so obviously not a microwave oven, but, you know, it makes for a funny tale.
Yeah. And it's not true.
No, it's not true. Because, and it gets twisted around. You'll find a bunch of stories like this.
Yeah. And I think you're right that those kind of go into a whimsical thing. And of course it's playing on gender stereotypes or age stereotypes.
Yeah. And they'll throw in a funny line, like, it's going to be hard to cook your dinner or your family dinner with that thing, you know, as they point to it or whatever, you know, and everybody gets a good chuckle out of it. And that's kind of the punchline to the joke.
Yeah.
And that's the whole thing. But I guess the underlying theme again is that clueless driver.
And you know what? Speaking of theft, I've got a pretty good one for you here. Okay. Have you heard that thieves armed with some high technology can break into your car just by recording the signal you use on your fob?
Is that right?
That is right. And here's how it goes. Now, you and I did an episode about the idea of remotely hacking cars earlier. And what we found was that it is A, possible, and B requires a little bit more work than you might think.
Yeah, it's pretty difficult.
Yeah, it's pretty difficult, but it is possible. So there are some very smart researchers who have been working to prove this stuff or find security holes so that they can patch those holes for car owners. As far as the likelihood of that happening to you, I'm going to go ahead and say it's low, because the kind of technology that we would require for this to happen would mean that the thieves would be professionals, not some, you know, bad kids, not some hooligans or delinquents just palling around to joyride. It would also probably mean that your car has to be worth the effort. So that means for, I'm sorry, guys, the vast majority of car owners, it's just not worth the time of a thief who is sophisticated enough to maybe be pulling supercars.
Yeah, they're not going to be hanging around me in the parking lot.
Don't beat yourself up, man.
No, that's true.
Yeah, they'll probably be after my car.
They're after the Monte Carlo.
They're after the Monte Carlo.
I'm sure of that.
I'm sure. I'm convinced.
Oh, which, by the way, and this is a complete side note.
Yeah.
You mentioned to me that your Monte Carlo is rated for mid-grade gas, and I was kind of poking fun at you for buying mid-grade gas, but you definitely should be buying mid-grade gas if it says it,
that's the rating.
So that was way off target, but we talked about that during the Dwarf Cars episode, and if you listen to that one, you'll understand what I mean. But I apologize, Ben.
Hey, there's no need to apologize. Okay. Maybe gas is an urban legend too. Gas ratings. Let's all just use regular fuel in everything. Regular fuel and jets.
You know, there's probably something in there for that too. More on that one? Okay. Yeah. Well, I've got one that I'm going to quickly go through here. This is about a fine for speeding. Now, if this is this is false. I'll tell you right up front. But they say that if you slightly overpay the fine for a traffic ticket, it'll keep the points off your driving record. Now, why would that happen? Now, why would you pay more and get the points off? And maybe you'd think that this is like an extortion, not extortion, but a bribery type thing, right?
Sure.
Like here's $100. How about we don't let those points show up on my license?
Driver miles.
It's nothing like that. This is totally different. It's not what I thought either. What happens is, and this is one of those pass this along type things, and it comes around at about 1998 is when this started.
Okay.
So it goes way back. But I guess the idea is that if you pay for your traffic infraction with a small amount over the fine, like let's just say a few dollars over.
All right.
So like let's say it's an $80 ticket, you pay $83.
Okay.
Something like that. That's a minor amount. You have to mail it in. You have to mail in a check. That's the only way this will work. So you overpay. Then they have to, by law, send you back a check for $3. Okay. And what you do then is you hold on to that check for $3 and never cash it. You just leave it out there as kind of an unpaid check, I guess.
Okay.
And you're sure that you never cash it, because until all financial transactions are finished, they are not allowed to proceed with that fine. And on the surface, this sounds like it's going to work, right? It sounds like that may be something worth looking into.
It sounds illegal.
Well, it does, and it sounds very clever, doesn't it? It sounds very like it's too good to be true, which we talked about as being something.
Yeah, one of the red flags.
Yeah, exactly. So, but the idea that the system has its money and it won't bother you with the points is completely false. Once you pay that, and even if you do overpay and they do send you a check back, that transaction is going through. Now, it's not to say that it's never happened, because there's probably been a case where something has slipped through the cracks.
Right.
There's probably been a case where, you didn't pay the fine and it slipped through the cracks. But it's not a cause and effect thing. It's something that has happened coincidentally in the past, but it probably will never happen again. I mean, it's the likelihood of it happening.
Don't bank on it.
Yeah, exactly. So don't bank on that one happening. That's a false statement.
Wouldn't they also cancel the check after 90 days or something anyway?
Exactly, Ben. That would happen, and then the points would go on either way. And I don't think that's the way it works anyways. Once you get the ticket, you pay the fine, because you're saying, I'm not going to bother to show up to court. Here's my fine. Here's my fee, I guess. They would automatically enter that as, okay, the that's paid and the points are issued. And then, oh, by the way, we have to send a check for $3 back to this guy because he overpaid.
And a little bit of additional myth-busting for the tall tales of diplomatic immunity in parking tickets. This is pretty interesting. There are quite a few foreign dignitaries and their staffers who have racked up just an obscene amount of parking tickets. They're not being prosecuted usually because it's kind of a courtesy.
Mm-hmm.
But make no mistake, it's still illegal. Diplomatic immunity is a lot more of a safeguard from unwarranted imprisonment than it is get out of jail free monopoly type thing.
Yeah, it's not when I think we've seen this on television. Everybody has, or in a movie when they double park in the city.
Yeah.
They jump out and they say, "Oh, you got to move this car." And like diplomatic immunity or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, they just shout that as a way to get off of every ticket, every speeding ticket, anything.
Right.
Anything
they're not
that
supposed
up.
To do that. That kind of stuff can happen. And to answer a question that I had heard from somebody earlier, they presented the following hypothetical. So what if you work for the State Department and you're, you know, head of a consular office or something? So you're not an ambassador, but you're high up enough that when you're stationed somewhere, you could potentially have diplomatic immunity. Does that apply in the United States? The answer is unambiguously, emphatically, with 1,000,000% certainty, no. Nope. Mm-hmm. Being in the State Department does not, should not legally get you out of any parking tickets.
So you're out of luck.
And you know what? By the way, guys, if you were planning to go into the State Department for that reason, you were already in the wrong line of work.
Yeah, that's right. Seek other employment opportunities, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Think, let's see, you want to go next?
You know what? I've got a stack of them, so let me do one more quick one. We'll hit one with you, and then maybe we can talk about, an audiobook that I am very excited about.
Okay, yes.
We'll do that in a minute, but right. I truly am excited about this one. It's really cool. All right, so this one's called, on Snopes, it's called Dotsons and Daughters. And what it's about is, now, just, this is kind of a legend, I guess.
All right.
Hilarity ensues when a clueless car owner misreads the model name of her family car. So right away, you know, here it is, the clueless car owner again. And this is, these have a lot to do with a female car owner calling into a parts desk, a parts counter, and saying, "I need this part." Okay.
Mm.
And they're trying to decipher what she means by getting that, right? So, okay. So the woman calls an import parts warehouse and asks for a 28 ounce water pump. And the confused parts guy says, "Well, what do you mean a 28 ounce water pump?"
Mm-hmm.
And she says, "Well, my husband says he needs a 28 ounce water pump. It's right here on the note." And he says, I don't understand what it means. And she says, what kind of car does it fit? And she says, a Datsun. And he writes out Datsun 28 ounce water pump. And he slaps his forehead and he says, 28 ounce is 280Z.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like, if you write these things out, you'll understand what it is. And what it is just a play on words. And this is clearly somebody who was looking at it one day and said, "It looks like 28 ounces. I'm going to kind of work this into a joke somehow. How am I going
to
do this?"
I don't know, man. I'm going to have to respectfully disagree. I think something like that has probably really happened.
Do you really think so?
Oh, yeah.
Maybe, because there's other cases. Now, there's one that, you know, okay, here's a case where they say, in quotes, a foreigner called in and asked for a repair part for a Pontiac Ghoulie. And you say, "What's a Pontiac Ghoulie?" Well, that's a 6000 LE. If you write it out, the six looks like a G kind of in a way, I guess, if you write it sloppy, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, a Ghoulie and the LE part is the limited edition. So Pontiac 6000 LE becomes Pontiac Ghoulie.
See, okay, that one is possible, but I don't believe that one is easy.
What about mispronunciations? Like a woman, of course, it's a woman again. A woman looking for a part for a Pontiac Gutto.
Oh, man.
That's a Pontiac GTO.
I know.
Yeah.
That's just so sexist.
A Gutto. Okay, yeah. And then here's probably, this is a funny one.
There's not even a vowel in it.
I know. And this is a funny one, I guess. And the same type of thing, you know, they call in the parts department part, and she's looking for a 710 cap. And the woman needs a 710 cap, and she's emphatic that I need a 710 cap. And the guy they just can't figure it out. And there's a lot of funny exchanges back and forth, like, "Well, what kind of car? And what, you know, where does it go exactly?" And they try to figure it out. And then finally, the mechanic or the parts department guy writes down 710, turns the paper upside down, and it reads oil, O-I-L. So if you look at 710 and you flip it upside down, it's oil.
No way.
So she's looking for an oil cap.
No, she's, that's.
I know.
Can't be real.
Well, of course it's not. It's a legend. So that's the reason. So, you know, these things are really funny, but you know, these are funny tales to read, but it's also something that you can relate to because you'll see some of the stuff passed around online as jokes or whatever.
Yeah.
But these go way back. I mean, some of the stuff like that 710 cap, that could go back to the dawn of the automobile from when they started labeling it as oil on the cap. It doesn't have to be a 280Z that, you know, came about whenever.
Right. Yeah.
This could go back as far as, you know, the car itself.
I think that's one of the strangest things. It's how old the sort of DNA of these auto urban legends actually is. Mm-hmm. Scott, before I go to the next one, which I think will be a mutual favorite of ours, let me follow up on that audiobook you mentioned.
Oh.
What's going on here? Is this an audible.com selection?
This is a star as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, wow.
And I'm not kidding with this one. I'm a true crime fan. We've talked about, in fact, just before this episode, we were talking about true crime,
mm-hmm.
right? And versions of that, right? This one has a lot to do with it, and it's not so much murder as it is just true crime.
Okay.
And you'll understand as I go through this, but I'll try to keep it brief. It's a great story.
All right.
Now, it's about 2 hours and 17 minutes long, and the name of this one, again, on audible.com, it's an audiobook. It's called Big Rigs, Posh Digs, Fast Cars, and Dark Bars.
I love the title.
It's kind of a funny title.
Yeah.
And what it is, it's about the greed-driven, sex-enhanced ride that cost Arrow Trucking Company $90 million and its life.
What?
Now, this is the event. This is the book that tells you the story, or chronicles the story, of how Arrow Trucking Company went out of business and why. And a lot of people have a very heavy interest in this because, of course, what you'll find out happened to the company, you know, that alone is big deal. This is a book by Charles Hood, and what it is, and I'll read just the summary, and then I'll tell you what it's really all about. It says it's a true story of crime and road rage in the executive suite of one of America's leading trucking companies, and the headquarters was in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And the story kind of begins, and I'll make a super fast summary here. The story kind of begins when this highly regarded founder and owner of the Arrow Trucking Company, his name was Jim, is killed in a hunting accident. And there's nothing, you know, unusual about that. Just, it was a hunting accident. It just happened. But his widow appoints their only son, Douglas, to be the new CEO of the company. So there's this massive company that now this kid is going to be appointed the CEO of. So nepotism, of course, is what's going
on
here. But, the kid has zero qualifications, no qualifications at all, but he's, quote, the apple of his mother's eye.
Oh, good.
And that's his qualification.
That'll work out.
He had no work experience of any kind of business at all. He had a high school education only. He never worked a single day in his life prior to this. And he was known as what they called an arrogant party boy. So this is the guy that's now in charge of one of the nation's largest trucking companies because his mother decided to appoint him that. So at one time, just to give you a quick idea, the company was extremely successful under the previous owner, his father, Jim.
Mm-hmm.
They owned 1,200 tractors. They had 1,400 flatbeds. They had very, very little debt.
Wow.
And they had something like 1,400 employees and revenues that exceeded $250 million annually.
That's wonderful.
So it's a great, great company.
It's great going.
Right? 8 years later, after Douglas takes over, the company had just $8.5 million in assets and $99.7 million in liabilities.
Whoa.
So 8 years later is when this whole thing kind of came about. Now, it happened in a long, slow slide, and that's what the story's about, because Dougie, as they called him, he led a lavish lifestyle, as you can imagine, and he had moved something like $40 million into his own personal accounts to support his lifestyle. One thing that he did that was just kind of outlandish, he bought a Dallas, Texas stripper, a Porsche, as a gift after seeing her perform on stage and had it delivered to her house on an Arrow Trucking flatbed truck. So that's one example of kind of this extravagant life. And then later this, I'm not giving anything away really.
Sure.
There's plenty more than
this
what I'll tell you. The stripper ends up leaving him for a female news anchor on a television station there locally, who is also the wife of a prominent businessman in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So there's this great big intrigue story that's going on as well. He hired somebody to maintain his closets and to change light bulbs in his house. He would regularly spend $80,000 on an American Express credit card that the company had issued him. And then I said regularly would spend $80,000. So that's multiple times he would spend that amount. There's a lot more than that. I mean, I'm just, you know, the tip of the iceberg on
this.
Is
he alive today?
He is, yes. And, the company closed in December of 2009. And here's how they found out. Now, this is Christmas time, December 2009. They found out the fuel cards for the trucks. Now they're all over the U.S.
Oh, I remember this. Yeah.
Yeah. They just suddenly stopped working.
Yeah.
The fuel cards wouldn't work. And they get this in-cab message that says, Just leave your truck exactly where it is. Find your way home. Arrow Trucking is no longer in business. And that's it. That's how this whole thing ends.
That's horrible.
It's, and this story, and I'll tell you, it's more gripping than what I'm making it out to be.
Yeah.
It's really a good story, and there's so many different angles to this thing.
And this is not a story for kids.
No, it's not. It's definitely not.
But you can check it out for yourself if you go to audiblepodcast.com/carstuff. Let them know that Scott and Ben sent you. You can get a free download of any audiobook of your choice. We're not saying it has to be this book. But we are saying that this book is fantastic. I'm actually going to go download it too.
And one minor thing, the narration when you first hear it, because I listened to the sample and I haven't downloaded the book yet. The sample, it sounds a bit echoey. And after about 2 minutes, you get past that, I promise you, because I listened to the sample and by the end, I didn't even think about this because the story is so fantastic. It overrides any of that. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit echoey. Truly stick with it for the 2 hours and you won't even think about it at the end because the story is going to be so gripping.
Yeah, and also on that note, I'm glad that you mentioned the true crime stuff that we both really enjoy. Everybody listening, let us know if you have some true crime auto stories that you would like to cover.
Oh, that's
that would
one.
Be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Which brings me to something that I think we both have, Scott. Do you remember that Johnny Cash song, One Piece at a Time?
I do.
I really enjoy that song.
I do, yeah.
I'm a sucker.
Cadillacs, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was kind of an amalgamation of a Cadillac after that. But this reminds me of a real life urban legend, here's the claim, a group of former GM workers produced 1957 Chevys on their own. Kind of like in the song.
Yeah, for 10 years.
For 10 years.
After production ended. Now I have this one. Ben, you and I both have this one. We were looking across the table at each other. I have this labeled as the best one.
Oh, really?
And I think it is. I think this is the best one out of my whole group of stories. So, I mean, it only appears once in print outside of Snopes, of course.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there'll be allusions to it, I guess, elsewhere, but they all go back to this one case, this one instance, and that is the People's Almanac of 1975. That's the only place that this story ever appeared in print as I guess, you could say as fact, other than, hey, by the way, did you see this? And did you hear the one about that type of thing? Right. So it goes back to 1975, and it's obviously, well, I think it's false, Ben. It's got to be false.
Yeah.
I think it's been proven to be false, really, mm-hmm. because the story is that, you know, this designer, this one guy in particular, his name is Ardell Malowick, I think. Is that how you say it? Ardell Malowick. He was an ex-GM stylist, and he was unhappy with GM's decision to change the Chevy design in 1958. They were going to switch over from the fin design, like in the 1957, which was, well, popular later, but not at the time.
Yep.
They were going to change over to, remember the longer, lower, wider whole chant, I guess, that they had there at GM and everywhere, really? They were going to change over the design for 1958, which they did, but this guy, apparently, he definitely didn't want that to happen, right?
Yeah. Eventually, Ardell, according to the story, quits GM. This around 1957, right? Mm-hmm. And he and some other like-minded men do a mutiny. And these are some of these guys are also former employees of GM. So they leave and they buy their own auto assembly factory somewhere in southern Illinois. Just a little place, I guess, as factories go. He wasn't able to get a hold of the molds and the steel presses that Fisher and GM used to make the body. So instead, they do coach building techniques, old school stuff, right? Pounding it out by hand over the wooden molds, fiberglass replicas and stuff. Then they knew that Chevy wouldn't consent to them making these 57s to compete with the 58s.
So let's just take one quick second here to straighten this out, because they claim that they made 200,000 fake 1957 Chevys between 1957 and 1967 at a factory that they just produced or they just purchased on a whim.
Out of thin air.
And they're creating them by hammering metal over wooden molds, right?
By hand.
They're making 200,000 cars in 10 years over this time without GM knowing about it.
Right, because apparently you can just buy auto factories.
Yeah, and the reason this... Yeah, exactly. Yeah, as we found out with Preston Tucker, that was just so easy to do, right?
Yeah.
So, all right, this has so many different things. Now, they're creating these knockoff cars, right, that they can't... that they can't sell as new. They can't sell as new Chevrolets. They sell them as used Chevrolets in great condition, right? Because they are really brand new. And they say that, you know, they were extremely sought after by used car dealers because they were in fantastic shape, of course. They're not a true Chevrolet. And I also saw something about pirated Chrysler engines and chassis that were used for these. You're talking about a 57 body, a 57 mm-hmm. Chevy body on a Chrysler chassis with a Chrysler engine.
Right.
And it's this knockoff that, you know, it's not going to be perfect if they do make one. Like, let's say it was like a kit car almost.
Right. Pretty much.
No way. But it wasn't really a kit car because they're building them at the factory. So they're trying to sell them as new. There's just so much with the story, Ben. It's so crazy. They finally claim they were forced to close, right?
Yeah. Okay. Well, how about this? How about if this were true, they would be under the jail. At least Ardell would.
Absolutely.
And, how about this? If you're selling cars, what about the taxes? You know, Uncle Sam wants his cut.
Yeah.
How do you report the revenue? How do you pay these people? Where's the chain of ownership? Where are the serial numbers?
Absolutely.
There are just so many reasons.
And maybe the biggest thing here. Now, this is the huge, like the one glaring mistake here is that, you know, the 57 Chevy is coveted by anybody who's a collector.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an iconic American car. People love this car. Not everybody, but people love it, right? Never has one of these counterfeited cars ever turned up anywhere. No one that anybody's ever contacted or talked to has ever been able to say that's a fake 1950 Chevy that was produced in Jacksonville, Illinois. I think it was Jacksonville, right?
Yeah, but, Scott, I think we can both agree that clearly that's because GM and Chevy purchased every single one of them and scrapped them.
Of course they did. Yeah, that's how these conspiracies work out,
right?
But no one can ever say, I've seen one, I've driven one, I owned one.
Sure.
Here's one down the block, you know, that my neighbor owns. There's not one in a museum anywhere.
Nope.
And supposedly there were 200,000 of these things that were built for 10 years without GM knowing about it. I just don't understand. And then GM at the end of that said, we'd really like you guys to just shut down. So, you know, in 1967,
no harm, no foul.
In 1967, there was no big, huge thing that's, you know, like a big court case or anything like that anybody would have heard of. It just didn't happen.
Well, those 57 homemade Chevys, those 200,000 57 homemade Chevys are, of course, as we know, evenly divided. They're government transport cars now. Half of them are at Area 51 and the other half are just used to drive around that enormous warehouse from Indiana Jones.
And there might be one on the moon.
Well, yeah, there's one on the moon.
Of course.
How else are you going to get around the moon?
Yeah.
Walking like a jerk?
And not that lunar rover that they told you about back then, right?
No, that's a cover story.
There's no way. No way.
What's that?
So I've got one that's, you know what? Let's kind of zip through these last ones.
Okay.
How about that?
Yeah.
I do have one. There's one here that was kind of false or was a legend and became true. So
okay.
I don't know if that'll hook you or not for the end of this.
But
okay, here's one. Not this one. This one is a legend. It's called Push Vroom, and I'll go through it quickly. A stranded motorist gets more than he bargained for when he asks for help push starting his car.
Okay.
And this one goes back to the early 1950s. I think around 1956 is when this one first started kind of making the rounds in newspapers because it was a kind of a funny story. And this is kind of an idea about the new, in quotes, automatic transmissions because they were relatively new at the time.
Yeah,
newfangled. Manual transmission had been around prior to that, mostly. It has to do with a motorist that has a dead battery in a parking lot. They can't, the guy says, well, we could push start it if it was a manual transmission. Mm-hmm. And then the guy says, well, wait a minute. I did hear that you could push start an automatic transmission, but you're going to have to get up to about 30 to 35 miles per hour, so I'm going to need a push from your car. And the guy, you know, the other motorist hears, you're going to have to get up to 30 or 35 miles per hour. So they kind of line each other up in the parking lot, you know, bumper to bumper, ready to start the push procedure to get up to 30, 35. And the motorist behind starts to back up and backs way, 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 way back. And the other motorist is confused at first and doesn't realize what's going on, thinking that the guy's leaving.
Then
the guy starts accelerating towards the car that is stalled or starts the car with a dead battery. And that's when the motorist realizes, I said 30 to 35 miles per hour is how fast you need to go. This guy thinks he needs to impact the car at 30 to 35 miles
an
hour. And in this story, you know, it goes back to the 50s, as I mentioned. But, as these types of things happen, you know, it just came about one day when someone was just kind of in an offhand way at a newspaper, had space to fill, and made kind of a joke, you know, never intending it to be a true story. Well, then it gets picked up by some other news source, and then before they can print a retraction, AP picks it up and it spreads throughout the country.
Wow.
If not throughout the world. And this happened almost immediately. And it's one of the, like, one of these early cases, I guess, of where something like this happened. And they can pinpoint it and say, like, well, this guy just made this up and printed it and went to here and then it went to here and then it was everywhere. And we still see this one pop up online occasionally. So it comes back. It's called Push Vroom if you want to look it up.
And tell your friends that it's not true.
Yeah, that's a funny one.
Yeah. Okay. Do you want to go? I've got like one more.
Why don't you go ahead? Oh, I'll tell you what. I'll go again, and then we'll hit yours, and then okay. I've got a couple other funny ones. So this one has to do with insurance claims, and these are, again, funny emails that get passed around a lot, you know, like a list, various kind of crazy insurance claim statements that people make when they have to summarize an accident in as few words as possible, and they eliminate some critical information that makes the statement exceedingly funny.
Sure. Tree dashed in front of me, refused to move.
That's exactly right, Ben. You know, things like that. So, you know, some funny ones, and I'll just read a couple. I thought my window was down, but I found it was up when I put my head through it. Things like that. I collided with a stationary truck coming the other way. Pedestrian hit me and went under my car. That guy was all over the road. I had to swerve several times before I hit him. Things like that. You know? And, you know, these appear here in the United States. They appear all over the place.
It's like after forcing me to drink alcohol, a deer jumped through my windshield.
Exactly. Yeah. And these things have been around since, you know, the earliest days of the automobile and insurance, I guess.
Yeah.
Just to give you an idea, from London, there was an insurance list of insurance claims like this made from the 1970s. And I think a stand-up comic used some of these in his routine.
Oh, yeah.
And some of them were like, and I'll show you how similar they are, the ones that we hear now.
Okay.
A bull was standing there and a fly must have tickled him because he gored my car. The accident was caused by me waving to the man I hit last week. Coming home, I grabbed into the wrong house and collided with a tree that I haven't got. And the last one, I guess, is I knocked over a man. He admitted that it was his fault. He said that he'd been knocked down before. So, you know, just odd little statements like this that, you know, you take out half of the information and you put together what's left in it, and it just becomes comical in the way they put it together. There could be some truth in some of these, but they're just trying to make it, you know, fit their the parameters, like 10 words or less or whatever it is.
I had heard one before about a this is going to sound terrible, but I used to work for a brief time with some insurance companies, and I would get calls from people when they had accidents and try to help them sort their stuff out, get an adjuster out to them and stuff. And we had some pretty strange claims.
I bet.
Yeah, there were people who would call and ask for legal advice. You know,
definitely can't give legal advice.
Why would you call your insurance company? I got some folks. There was this one guy who called from Ohio, and he said, I just got in an accident. I don't want the police to be involved. I just wanted to let you guys know I'm going to need my car fixed. And I said, well, sir, what's the accident like? And he said, oh, I don't know. They're a few miles behind me now.
Oh,
I'm just going to keep going.
Oh, no.
So he called in a hit and run.
Oh, my God. He called in his own hit and run.
On himself. Mm. Asked me for legal advice.
That is bad news.
Yeah, and then cursed at me.
All right. So you want to hit me with the last one here?
Okay. You're familiar with this one. I think we may have covered this a little bit already. Scott, have you heard that early in the days of public transit in the United States, the major metropolitan areas were lousy with efficient electric train cars?
Yes.
And that the story goes, or the urban legend goes, that automotive companies and Firestone Tires, I think, conspired to buy up and destroy these public transit systems so that they could sell more cars. Now, I'm going to let you do the honors on this one. What do you think?
Oh, that's absolutely true.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah.
I just had to bring it up because it sounds so tinfoil hat.
There's even a name for it. It's like the great rail car conspiracy or something.
Yeah, the great trolley conspiracy.
Something like that. Yeah, we've talked about that in the past on this show. And I think we have an article on our website, I believe.
And you can see a documentary about it called Who Killed the Electric Car? Now, before you go thinking that we're painting these guys as huge villains, There are quite a few questions on the other side. Like, we do know that they did buy up these cars, but there's a great question about how successful the electric train system was at the time, mm-hmm. how long it would have lasted without that intervention. It is, however, true that they were found guilty of conspiracy in court, for which they were charged the life-ruining fine of $1 U.S.
Yeah, that was well, you got to put yourself in the time, Ben.
Right, and calculate for inflation.
I mean, my gosh, what was $1 in the 30s, 40s?
Yeah, I think you could buy Kansas.
Man, $1, that was an exceedingly high fine, even for back then.
Anyway, right. That's fine.
All right, so I've got just three more to wrap up with, and tell you what, I'm going to do two of them super fast because I think the one I want to get to is the one that has turned true that was originally a legend.
Great.
And I'll summarize these. I'll give you the name of them, and I'll let the listeners look them up, I think. Maybe that's the way to do it, because these are ones that everybody's heard of in the last 5 years.
All right.
All right, this one is called The Unkindest Cut. And this is where thieves lie in wait under victims' cars and then render their victim helpless by slashing their ankles.
Yeah.
I think everybody in every town has heard this tale of, it's usually a female at the mall late at night.
Yeah.
Walks out to her car.
Or something.
Yeah. Somebody reaches out from underneath the car, slashes her ankles, and, you know, it either ends with, rape, robbery, murder in some cases, you know, all kinds of bad things happen.
Yeah.
And, we hear about this happening at malls, and it goes all the way back to like the 1970s, I think. When these kind of urban legend strings kind of go around. And there's a, I mean, they're all over the United States. I mean, everywhere. I mean, Ohio, North Dakota, Indiana, Maryland, California, it's everywhere. I mean, I've got a long list here in front of me. And you can find it on Snopes.com. But it is a false thing. And that's not to say that it hasn't ever happened, because I believe there was a case in the 1990s, but I could be wrong on that. It did happen. Oh, no, I'm sorry. In 2008, someone did actually have somebody hide under the car in Salt Lake City, Utah. It happened to a woman at a mall, I believe it was. But it rarely, rarely happens. And,
right. It's not an organized tactic.
And the main theme about this one, Ben, and think about this, if you think about this carefully, and I hadn't thought about this prior to this, It comes back to a childhood fear. It's one of those morality type stories.
Under the bed, huh?
It's the boogeyman under the bed. And I hadn't thought about that until I read it in Snopes, that this is the boogeyman under the bed coming to life, I guess, or, you know, in the adult form. The next one is called Lights Out, and that is also false. I can just put that out there.
Oh, I think I know this one.
What is this one?
Is this the gang initiation idea?
This is.
Okay, so in this urban legend, you'll hear multiple gangs named as the source of this, but the idea is that the gangs carjack a vehicle and they have an initiation with one of their newest members in the car, or their would-be member, and they just drive down the road with their high beams on.
No, with no lights on.
Oh, with no lights on.
No lights on.
Oh, and it's the first person who flashes them. I heard it was drive with the highs on, but drive with no lights on, and the first person who flashes them, they chase that car. And then they kill the people in it.
Yeah, that's right. And you've got a variation on that, which I had never thought of, Ben. That's the thing. These things adapt along the way. So you may have heard the high beam thing.
I heard they drove with the high beams.
I have always heard it with no lights on, and then people would give them the courtesy flash. But you're right, with high beams, you do the same thing, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
So again, that's just another indicator. But I can tell you the first time I heard about this, Ben, was in the 1990s, and I was working at a landscaping nursery.
Yeah.
And someone came back from lunchtime, I think. They had gone into town, into Auburn Hills there in town in Michigan. And they came back and said, I've got something I got to tell all three of you while you're here. They just came into the bar I was in and made this big announcement. The Auburn Hills police are telling you to watch out for people with their lights off at night. You don't want to flash your lights because it's a gang initiation and they're going to kill you if you do.
Wow.
And it happened to somebody in this state. You know, it was like over in Indiana or something, or in Illinois or wherever it was. And it made a huge impression on me. And it kind of went around like that for a long time, you know, word of mouth. And then it went online when that became popular in the late 90s, I'd say.
And it's always something like, my cousin's dentist therapist told me.
Do you know, Ben, that just... I mean, I'm not kidding. 1 week ago, someone was driving down the road without their lights on, and I flashed the lights on and off to them to tell them their lights were on, because they were coming out of an area that was well lit.
I see you like to look
and
dangerously.
I did that, and my wife went crazy.
What?
She said, what are you doing? Don't ever do that. And I said, that's just a rumor. It's an urban legend. Yeah. I tried to tell her, and this was literally like 7 or 10 days ago when this happened.
Oh, choose your battles.
We had this big discussion about it. So anyways, it's called Lights Out. You can look it up on Snopes.com. Now, the last one, I know we're going long here. We've talked almost an hour about this, but I think these are interesting topics. I hope they are. This is one that has kind of turned true in a way. And it's called the Lost Wreck. And it's about work crews that discover decades-old wreck car with several skeletons inside. And there were accounts of this happening all the way back into the 19th century in a different way, though. Not with an automobile, like you might think.
Or like a horse and buggy?
Well, it's a Scandinavian tale. It's a Scandinavian legend that goes back to a hunter who's out in the woods hunting. He's shooting for a grouse, I think. And he uses a bow and arrow, it tells you how long ago this was. He's using a bow and arrow, and he shoots into the woods, and he hears a clang. And he goes to investigate what that clang was, and as he pulls apart the brush, he realizes that he's just discovered a church that has been abandoned since the days of the Black Plague.
Oh, my gosh.
And he found this abandoned church somewhere out in the middle of nowhere that was abandoned. And this is the exact same tale that leads to something along the lines of finding a wreck that had been submerged or in the woods or just somewhere relatively easy to find, but no one has come across it yet. And there's people inside. And the underlying tale with this one is that, you know, people have a fear of somebody not missing them when they go missing. That, you know, how long will it take before someone finds me if I do go missing? It's kind of a lost at sea type thing, really.
Yeah.
But in an urban environment, really, or semi-rural or whatever you want to call it. But there are a few of these tales that have become absolutely true within the last, I'd say, 20 years, maybe 30 years, 25 years. And this begins, I'm sure that there were other cases of this, and this is where I'll kind of wrap up here, I promise, where it's true is, and I can think of three cases since 1990 all the way through last year when this happened.
I think I can add a fourth pretty soon.
Can you really? Okay.
Maybe.
All right.
See.
All right. So there's a woman named Susie Roberts out of Gainesville, Georgia, who disappeared with a friend while they were on their way home from a dance in the nearby town of Dawsonville one day in 1958. And although the friend's body turned up a year later, Robert's body remained undiscovered until, I think it was 1990. So that's 32 years later.
Oh my gosh.
When workers were building a bridge and they found this car and pulled it out and it contained the remains of it. She was in Lake Lanier. She was in the bottom of Lake Lanier for 32 years in this car and they had no idea where she was. Another one is, this is the one that we've talked about this on this podcast. Something happened with this story when I was in Florida, and I don't remember if they actually found the van or they discovered the skeletons or whatever, but the story is that Kimberly Marie Barnes and four of her friends, so there's five people in this van, they were in Palm Beach, Florida, and they were going to, I think they were going to a concert, I believe, and it was like a summer evening, 1979, they just completely disappeared, vanished off the face of the earth. No one knew where they were until I think a fisherman found a van in a canal, something like 18 years later. So it was like 1997, somewhere around there, when they found this van buried. And they were about ready to crush it. And just as the guy was ready to crush it, he was moving the crane into place or whatever. And I think a skull popped out. A leg bone.
Oh, man.
He spotted a leg bone inside the van. And then they kind of investigated because it was full of mud and everything. Ooh. They found five skeletons in the van. It was definitely this Kimberly Ann Barnes and her four friends. And something with that story happened right while I was in Florida because it was all over the news. It was a huge deal. And then the last one, I promise I'll wrap it up with this. In September of 2013, and this is going to be one that's fresh on everybody's minds, I would hope, there were some highway patrol officers who were testing new sonar equipment in Foss Lake in a remote area of southwestern Oklahoma, and they discovered two submerged, decades-old cars that contained a total of six human skulls and matching bones. So six people in two different cars in the same lake, and they were just feet apart. Do you remember this?
Yeah, but do they think it was accidental?
No, it was definitely accidental. It was super muddy water, like it was completely murky and muddy and covered up, and it was right off the side of the road. And they found one vehicle, and as they're testing their equipment, they found another one right next to it. And the car's been, one disappeared in 1970, the other one disappeared in 1969, so one just predates it by 1 year. They were both found in 2013, so 43 and 44 years missing. And, just an unusual story. One of them was a 1952 Chevy. And the other one was a, I believe it was a 69 Camaro, I think, that they found.
So you don't think, you don't think there's any skullduggery there?
Oh, absolutely not. These are two people that drove off the road, ended up in the water, knocked out, and then died, drowned.
Yeah.
But they just happened, the cars didn't collide. The car went, was fully submerged. No one was around to witness it. And no one thought to look for tracks the day of or the day after. And then when it rained or whatever,
it washed it away.
It's washed away. And no one ever found that until, 43, 44 years later.
Now, you know, this, as frightening as this is, this makes me think of an episode we should do in the future, which is how to escape a submerged car.
It's a very good idea. Yeah. That's an excellent skill to have.
Yeah.
And it does take skill.
Yeah, the most difficult part, of course, of escaping from a submerged car is the same difficult part of any emergency situation, which is not panicking and keeping your head and moving in a methodical fashion.
Thinking clearly, which is easy to say here, but
when
it's happening, nope, you can't do it. So you had one more to add, right?
One more submerged thing, and this is kind of an umbrella thing, which is tangentially related. Submarines. Since the advent of submarines, right, when we started seeing a lot of mass production of submarines, especially in World War II, culminating there, the problem was that a lot of the submarines, especially those used by Nazi Germany, were manufactured, you know, with, of course, there's a little bit of secrecy there and occultation because they don't want the Allies or, you know, in somebody else's case, the Axis, to know how many subs they have. Mm-hmm. And they're also, it's wartime, so they're doing a lot of experimentation without some of the same safety procedures they would have in times of peace. What this means is that it is completely possible that there are missing or capsized submarines down there somewhere in the deep right now that have just never been recovered and have a full crew.
Yeah, and never will be, because they rest on the bottom of some of the deepest parts of the ocean.
Right. Mm-hmm. Sunk all the way down to the abyssal plain or
interesting,
whatever.
Scary thought.
Yeah, man, that's a scary thought. So let's end this. Let's go ahead and end this with something a little bit lighter. How about some listener mail?
Let's do it.
Okay, so Craig C. writes into us to say, Scott and Ben, great show. I have a 1964 Barracuda that I've been working on for the past 10 years on and off. The car was given to me as the owner was ready to scrap it since no one wanted it. The pictures alone should tell its history, and at times it's been a challenge to keep moving forward on it. Your podcast from 2012 talking about animal cars and painting your car, which I listened to today, inspired me to shoot this email to you. And yes, I do see more Monte Carlos on the road now.
Yeah, see, he's looking for them, right?
Yeah.
You know what? That's a really nice car that he's been working on.
Yeah, you saw the photos, too.
I did see them. That 64 Barracuda, that's a beautiful car. It's really
beautiful.
Cool. Curved back windshield.
Mm-hmm.
My uncle had one. I think he had the first Barracuda in Wabash County or something like that in Indiana.
Whoa.
Something like that. There's some story behind
Uncle Warbucks, huh?
Not really. It was just, you know, a new car at the time, and he had one, and before anybody else. It was definitely a cool design, and I really like the one that is it Craig?
Yeah, Craig.
Yeah, Craig. Thanks, Craig, for sending that in. I really like the photos a lot. That was really cool. It's a gold color, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Craig, I'm glad that you feel inspired, because as we've covered before, it can just be a massive project in terms of time and or money.
Well, I saw the early photos from Craig, and there were, I mean, literally there was moss on the back end of this car. So he's done a fantastic job.
And as you go
job.
Through the photos, you see some tremendous progress made there.
Definitely. Yeah. I don't know if it's a show car now or not. I couldn't really tell, but it's a beautiful car. It's really nice.
Yeah. And we'd love to see more photos too.
Definitely.
As you're going with it. So that's it for us today. Our episode on more urban legends, which obviously, Scott, you and I find fascinating. Listeners, we hope you enjoyed it too. Visit us at carstuffshow.com. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, where we are CarStuffHSW, and send us an email with your favorite urban legend. Our address is
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.